with the opening of the Chumash of Shemos, we move from the story, the prehistory of the Jewish people, to the chapter one, really, of us as a people. And it doesn't start easy. Things will get more difficult before they get better. And it isn't long enumerating the Shemos B'nai Yisrael who enter Mitzrayim. Before too long, there's a new king, new regime, and a new new picture. Yakom Melech Chadosh al Mitzrayim. A new king, he's either new, he's renewed. He doesn't know Yosef. And what does he say? Pasuk Tes, Vayome Elamo, Hine Am B'nai Yisrael, Rav Atzum Mimenu. He says to his people, behold, the Jewish people, they're greater, they're mightier than us. And that itself is an interesting thing to say. They are more numerous than us. Rav, as opposed to Atzum, Rav is quantities. Does Paro really believe there's more Jewish people than there are Egyptians? Maybe he never left the palace, so he has no idea. I think it's often true that people who've never met Jews imagine there's many more of them than there actually are, judging by the papers. The Ksav HaKabbalah, as he often does, explains that the word Rav is not an adjective. It's a verb. Rav means more numerous. They're not more numerous than we are. But they are multiplying at a rate greater than us. Rav is mitrabe, because the Jewish people, they're having six at a time, and the Egyptians are having 0.75 at a time, and therefore the expansion rate of the Jewish people, it's just a matter of time. They're what's known as a demographic time bomb. Rav va'atzum mimenu. Others say that the word mimenu doesn't necessarily translate as more than us, but from us. Mimenu, from us. He sees the success of the Jewish people and says it's from us. We look at all the things they're doing, and they're taking opportunities away from us. Those are jobs that could have been had by good Egyptian citizens. What is often true and often unbeknown to people who make a statement like that is those opportunities were created by Yisrael. They wouldn't exist otherwise. It's easy to look at the reality and then imagine backwards. But be that as it may, Paro feels he needs to take action. Hoban is chakmalo. Let us deal wisely with them. And your bet, lest they increase, vaya, and it will be kisikrenu melchamar, if there'll be a war. And there were wars at that time, as we know. They will attach themselves to our enemies. No question about it. There's no doubt in Paro's mind, seemingly. So these are Paro's fears concerning the Jewish people. It's not often that we receive a commentary on a pasuk in the Chumash from another pasuk in the Chumash. But when it comes to numerous psukim in Chumash Shemos, that is exactly what happens. And the reason why is because the Haggadah Shel Pesach makes associations between psukim at a later stage in the Chumash towards the end and these earlier Chumashim. We refer, of course, to the section in Parshas Kisavo, those four or five psukim, Aramiya Ve'Davi. And the heart of Magid is to take that section and to take it apart and to explain it word by word, phrase by phrase. And we're constantly to-ing and fro-ing from there in Aramiya Ve'Davi in Parshas Kisavo back to the scene of the crime. Kamoshin Emar. I think the most often recited words on Seder night are Kamoshin Emar. Although that might depend how you sing Dayenu, but Kamoshin Amar is certainly up there. And as we know, one of the things we say in that section of Aramiya Beit Avi, we begin to describe the persecution that the Egyptians ruled on the Jewish people. Vayareu osanu hamitzrim vayanunu. They were evil to us, they persecuted us. And as we said, each of these phrases then receives its proof text. We go back and fill it out. And the proof text for the words Vayareu osanu hamitzrim, the Mitzrim were evil to us, is none other than our pasuk yud, Havan ischak malo, pen yirbe, kisikrena milchama, etc. And as we can appreciate, that's not a natural fit. Because Vayareu osanu hamitzrim, they were evil to us. I think there's no lack of psukim in the beginning of Shemos which detail and describe how the Egyptians were evil to us, and we don't bring any of those psukim. We actually bring the pasuk of Havan ischak malo, which does not describe the Egyptians being evil to us, but actually their suspicions of how we might do the wrong thing by them. What's that got to do with Vayareu osanu hamitzrim? The Beis Halevi explains. Paro is very wise, and his wisdom is actually self-professed in the beginning of Pasuk Yud, Havan ischak malo. We need to be wise here. What's the wisdom in his plan? I mean, it takes a lot of organization, but in what way is he wise? He's wise in the sense that to enslave and persecute a people that have done nothing wrong just because you don't like them is no simple matter. Apart from the fact Paro is a monarch, there's other peoples in the region. He does not wish to sow any seeds of unrest amongst anyone else. And all of a sudden, he targets this people, alo avel bechapam, having done nothing wrong. How can he explain it? How can he justify it? How can he instigate it? And therein, says Beis Halevi, lies the wisdom of Paro. The way that he prepares the landscape for the oppression of the Jewish people is to begin by whipping up hysteria amongst the people in terms of what the Jews are about to do to them if they don't take action. It's interesting, Pasuk Tes says, Vayomer el Amo, he says to his nation. It's not often that we hear Paro address the nation or get a message to the nation. He doesn't care about the nation. He might talk to his select cabinet. But this is a message to the nation because he wants this to get through to Egyptians, as if to say, Egypt is under siege, and they are the enemy. Which means that by the time he comes to oppress and enslave the Jewish people, which cannot happen without the nationwide support and involvement of the Egyptian people, they are doing nothing other than protecting themselves. They are doing nothing other than defending their rights as Egyptian citizens. Or to put it differently, what we are looking at is propaganda min hatorah minayin. Where do we see that one begins by demonizing and by vilifying the Jewish people? Once that's done, everything else is practically guaranteed and moreover can be fully justified and rationalized. What does this have to do with the words Vayoreyu osanu hamitzrim? We normally interpret those words to mean Vayoreyu osanu, they were evil to us. However, there's a Lashon HaKodesh point, because the way to say that they were evil to us would not be Vayoreyu osanu, but would rather be Vayoreyu lonu. As indeed in Parshas Chukas we have practically the identical phrase when Moshe sends a delegation to whoever it is, to Edom and so on and so forth, he uses that expression, Vayoreyu lanu hamitzrim, they were evil to us. But if that's what it should say, Vayoreyu lanu, then what does it mean when it says Vayoreyu osanu? Vayoreyu osanu doesn't mean that they were evil to us, but they made us evil. Vayoreyu osanu, they made us into the ro'im. That's how it begins. You cannot pick on an innocent people, but you can defend yourselves against a villainous people. So it starts with Vayareu Osonu, and then everything that follows Vayanunu is more or less self understood. And as we can appreciate, the beginning of Parshas Shemos, we would call it Maase Avos Siman Labonim. We're no longer in the Avos, but this is the root exile experience of the Jewish people. And all of the themes and all of the machinations that we can perceive in the beginning of Chumash Shemos would rear their head again. As the Chidah points out, Shemos begins by saying, Ve'ele Shemos b'nei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayim. They're coming to Mitzrayim. The word ba'im has four letters, Beis, Aleph, Yud, and Mem. Denoting, says the Chidah, Bavel, Edom, Yavon, and Modai. This is the root exile experience, which will then have these four branches, but what you see in the branch can already be perceived in the root, as we know. And that is why, as the Beis Halevi says, very often in Jewish exile experience, when the Jews are degraded and when they are accused of wrongdoing, it's not just a matter of national pride. Trouble is coming. And that, unfortunately, is a story that would echo and reverberate in many situations to come. So this is the sowing the climate for the oppression. Hava nischak malo, vayareu osanu hamitzrim. And the first step, pasuk yud aleph, is vayosimu alav sarei misim. He placed on them sarei misim. That's stage one of oppression. And the question, interestingly, is what does sarei misim mean? I believe the stock translation, almost the Pavlovian translation for sarei misim is taskmasters. That clearly is not correct. Misim are not tasks. Rashi explains sarei misim lashon mas. Misim is tax. Everybody knows what misim are. Certain things we took out of Egypt with us. So misim is mas sarim shegovim mehem hamas. It began with excessive, discriminating taxation. Okay, so sarim misim, not so much taskmasters, but taxmasters. Okay. Interestingly, if you look at Unculus, Unculus does not translate sarei misim as tech masters, but rather shiltonin mavishim, officers who were evil to them. And the question is, how does sarei misim come to mean officers that were evil? I mean, people have their opinions about taxation, but how does the translation of the word sarei misim become shiltonin mavishim? Says the Netziv in the Hamak Davar, Unculus looks at the word misim and has a different reaction than Rashi. Rashi looks at misim and sees mas, tax. And we find the word mas for tax in a number of places throughout the Tanakh. in the end of Megillas Esther, Vayosam Amelech Achashverosh, mas al haaretz. So you have tax there at the end of Megillas Esther. I believe there are some shuls where they save some of their heartiest noise-making for that section. But Unculus understands differently. Misim comes from the word mimisim, to melt, that is to say, to break something down. By yimas levavenu, he masu es levavenu. In other words, sarei misim, according to Unculus, is not from the word mas, but from the word lehamis, to melt, to terrorize, and to dishearten, and to break them down. Shiltonim mavishim. And having provided the background for these two approaches, quite different from each other, mas is tax, mimis is to melt, is to dishearten, the Netziv says, at the end of the day, both of those connotations derive from this one word. And in order to understand the background to what he's about to say, The Netziv, in his introduction to the HaMikdavar, called Kidmas HaEmek, is a number of paragraphs where he presents certain yesodos in Lashon HaKodesh. It's really fascinating to go through, which he then bears out over the balance of the commentary HaMikdavar. And one of the principles that he presents and develops in the Kidmas HaEmek is the concept of Milim Murkavot. Milim Murkavot means composite words. And what does that mean? As we know, Lashon HaKodesh has well-defined parameters and categories. It's got its nouns, it's got its Lashon Zohar, Lashon Nekeva, it's got its passive and causative and active and all of those. By and large, any given word in the Chumash can be understood as belonging to one of those categories. Very clear. But once in a while, the Torah does something very interesting. The Torah blends words. It relaxes, shall we say, the borders between the various categories and grafts together different elements from different words and puts them into one word. And that means that that word no longer answers to any recognized category. If you try and put it into one box, it won't fit, because it actually comes from two boxes. And an example of that is the word Saremisim. After all, let's begin with Rashi. Rashi says Misim means taxes, from the word Mas. Says in Netziv, I'll ask you an interesting shaila. How did the plural of mas become misim? After all, I mean, things go missing, but you know what I mean. But if the word is mas, then the plural should be masim. It's an interesting shaila. Never seen anyone talk about it before. And just to help us along, the word masim never appears in the word mas never appears in the plural anywhere else in Tanakh. So mas became misim, but that's not the pure plural of mas. And that is why Unkelus explains that you see entry to the other understanding. It's called, the word is misim because they were mimisim, because they melted. That's Unkelus' element of evil doing. On the other hand, it cannot be just Unkelus, because misim is an entity. It's a noun. But memisim is a verb. So saremisim are clearly officers of something, but you can't be an officer of doing something bad. That's a construct with a verb. And therefore, misim is a thing. It's an entity. It's a plural noun. But it's not spelt like a plural noun. But it's got the letters of a plural noun and the vowelization of evil doing. And thus did the Torah graft together effectively the connotations that would lead to Unkelus, Mimisim, that's the Nikud, with Rashi, Masim, which is the letters. And it's a very, very interesting idea, and there's many other examples in the commentary of the HaMikdavar himself, as indeed other Mefarshim, each one in their own way, develop the idea of Milim or Kavot, how the Torah, it uses words as tools. And if there's more than one thing going on in the situation, very often there's more than one thing going on in the word. That's a very interesting idea. So this is Saremisim, as explained by the Netziv. Now, what's interesting about the beginning of Shemos is that one sees a kind of a juxtaposition between the story of the Jewish people and the story of Jewish people. In the sense that you have this juxtaposition, one could say, of the macro and the micro, the national and the individual. So in the beginning, they are being enslaved as a people, and then we hear the stories of certain individuals, Shifra and Puah, the Mialdos HaIvrios, those are two individuals, they take a stand, then Moshe comes on the scene, Batya has her input, and then we come to the story of Moshe's first, seemingly his first foray amongst his people. And I would like to take some time over the psukim of in Perek Beis, Pasuk Yud Aleph, and Yud Beis. As we will see, the Psukim are well known, all the more reason, as always, to take a good look at them. Vayhi bayamim ahem. In those days, Vayigdal Moshe Vayetze El Achav, he goes out to his brethren. Vayabisiv losam. And he sees their burdens, and specifically, and now we get to the story of one particular person, I mean two protagonists here. Bayar Ish Mitzri, he saw an Egyptian man, Make Ish Ivri Me Echav, beating a Hebrew man, Me Echav, from his brothers, that is to say, from Moshe's brother. Okay. What does he do? Vayifin Kovacho, he looks here, he looks there. Vayakein ish, he sees there's no one around. Vayaches a mitzri, vayitmenehu bechol. He kills the mitzri and buries him. Now, Rashi, amazingly, takes the entire episode and presents it in light of information that we have regarding the background. It's very vague. Who's the ish mitzri? Who's the Ish Ivri? Is there a story behind this? Indeed there is. Says Rashi, this Ish Ivri is none other than the Ish Ivri is the husband of Shlomis Bas Divri. And her son will become famous in the end of Parshas Emor. And the Egyptian officer, he took a liking to her, and he got rid of the husband, and he was with her. She thought she didn't know who he was. And then the husband comes back early in the morning, and the Mitzri has been found out by the Ish Ivri, who he banished from the house. So the Ish Mitzri, he does, I guess, what he thought was the honorable thing, and starts beating the daylights out of this Ish Ivri, because he knows that he has his secret, and he's wise to his misdemeanor. And then when Moshe comes, and he comes to the point where the Mitzri is beating the Ivri, so Rashi says, Vayifin Kovacho, which translates as, he looked here, he looked there. And Rashi comments, Ro'o ma'osolo babayis, u'ma'osolo basodeh. He knows, Moshe knows, because he's Moshe. So he knows what happened the night before. What the Mitzri did with his person's wife. He knows what he's doing now and why. Babayis ubasode, at home and now in the field. And that's vayifin kovacho. He looks here, he looks there. Means he sees what happened here, he sees what happened there, and he's about to take action. It's an amazing perush of Rashi. Vayifin kovacho. One would have thought vayifin kovacho literally means, or simply means, he looked here, he looked there. And indeed, Rashi's final words are, Ulufi pshuto, kemashmo, and on a pshat level, it's like what it sounds like. He looked here and looked there. So it's very interesting, this the way that Rashi is composed here. We're familiar with the idea that Rashi will sometimes bring explanations which are beyond the pshat, if necessary. Mostly, it's just pshat, if necessary, beyond pshat. But here, he actually prefaces with this what cannot be a pshat explanation, vayifin kovacho, he sees what happened there, he sees what happened there. And then in the end, just that we shouldn't leave with that with no pshat input in the pasuk, Rashi signs off by saying, ulefi pshuto kemashmo. But why does Rashi not just explain according to the pshat, and why does he relegate the pshat to second in his comment? I would think it's very straightforward. Well, the Mizrahi says, very simply, that when you think about it, vayifin kovacho, that those words are completely redundant. Because, I mean, they're very descriptive and they're very narrative, but at the end of the day, what does it mean to say? As the Pasuk says, vayarki ein ish, he saw there's no one there. Which means the main point is, he saw there's no one there. How did he know that no one's there? Well, first he looked this way, and then he looked that way. Maybe there's another way. As if to say, for what they are, they don't seem to be adding anything substantial to the situation, because at the end of the day, what you mean to say is what you continue to say. Vayaki ein ish. And therefore, by force of redundancy, Rashi says there's something else that he's seeing when he looks here and he looks there. Something deeper in the situation. That's how the Mizrahi explains. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a somewhat more, I would say, practical response to this question. Namely, in the following psukim, we see that on day two, he goes out and he sees two Hebrews and they're fighting and he gets involved with them. And then one says to the other, what are you going to do? You're going to kill me like you killed the Mitzri? Which means that someone was there because people know about it. So, Vayifin Kovacho, it's hard to explain that he didn't seemingly look successfully, because he looked here, looked there, and still someone knew about it. So, and hence Rashi explains that Vayifin Kovacho means this is part of the background to Moshe's action here. The reason why he kills him is because Vayifin Kovacho, the person deserves it because of what he did, Babayis, with this person's wife, and Basode, that he's beating him now. And the interesting question is, once we appreciate through Rashi that Vayifin Kovacho is really the basis of Moshe's actions, he judges him liable of being killed due to these two infractions, Babayis uVasode, do we need both of them? Is it specifically the combination because of what he did in the house and in the field? Would one of them not be enough? This question is discussed by Rabbi David Pardo, the Maskila David. And he says that indeed Moshe's actions were a combination, or more correctly, based on the combined wrongdoings, Babayis uVasode. How so? Well, let's start with what happened Babayis. I mean, this Mitzri was with this Ivri's wife, and that itself is a capital offense, even for Bnei Noach. However, there's just one problem. Namely, that even if a Ben Noach has violated the laws of Arayos and he's been involved with someone else's wife, you can't just strike him dead in the field. I mean, there's a concept called Bezdin, which is another of the Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach. There's a concept of due process. He needs to be executed by a court. You can't issue a citizen's execution based on even if what he did was wrong. So what enables Moshe to act in the field? There's only really one situation which empowers any given person to take terminal action just without outside of a Bezdin, and that is when someone else is about to be killed. Wrongly. It's known as Rodef. Rodef, if a person is wrongfully looking to kill someone, you can save that person by killing the pursuer. And this Mitzri is a pursuer. He's beating this Jew to death. And therefore, says Maskil David, we understand why it's not sufficient that Moshe knew what happened by bias, because that doesn't warrant you taking action here in this extrajudicial capacity. But because of what's happening by Sode, and he fully intends to kill him, so Moshe is empowered to take action midin Rodef. The question, of course, is, so then Sode is enough because he's looking to kill this Jew. So all you need is the second infraction of what's happening. He's beating him to death. Why do we still need the first one of what happened by Bias? Says Maskila David. The reason why is because there's an interesting halacha with regards to taking preemptive action regarding a rodef. A pursuer is looking to kill someone. And I think we'll all appreciate it. Namely, your goal is not to kill them. Your goal is to prevent them murdering someone, which means it's more to disable them. In the words of the Gemara, Nitan lahatzilo be'echad me'evarov. What if you could maim them? What if you could stop them in a way that doesn't kill them? If that's the case, you have to do that. You can't kill them just because they're going to do something wrong. The main priority is to disable them. How does Moshe kill this Mitzri? He uses the Shema Meforesh. And the Maskil David doesn't say it in exactly these ways. But if there's a Shema Meforesh that's capable of killing someone, presumably there's a Shema Meforesh that's capable of maiming someone. Or stunning them, at least. To the extent that they're disabled and are no longer able to carry out their crime of murder. And therefore, says Maskele David, we're just for the second idea that he's looking to kill the person, so you're entitled to stop him, but not necessarily with such extreme prejudice as to kill him. And that is why it's really the combination of the fact that he's chayav misa anyway, based on what he did in the house. At that point, when that combines with his crime he's about to commit of murdering this Jew, the two come together, and when Moshe stops him, he stops him absolutely. And that's vayar, it's vayaches hamitzri vayetmenehu b'chol. So that's an interesting discussion of, once Rashi has brought it down to the motivators for Moshe's action, why you need two of them. And there's one final point that needs consideration in Rashi. Rashi's explained by Yifen Kovacho, he looks into what this mitzri did, Babayis, Ubasoder, and then it says Vayarki Ein Ish, and as we've already explained, there were people there. So what does Vayarki Ein Ish mean? And here too, Rashi gives an incredible explanation. Ein Ish means there's no one who is osid lotzeis mimenu sheyis gayer. There's no one that was going to come out from him that would ever convert or come to any good end, which means nothing as good is going to come from him, and at that point, Moshe kills him. And this leads us to a very interesting question. Again, we've established this person has forfeited his life. And if Moshe doesn't kill him before ascertaining that no one in the future would ever come to be part of the Jewish people or anything like that. And that's quite a high standard of berurim, investigations, before judging that a person should be killed. Generally speaking, if a person is liable to be killed, we don't ask a question like that. Do you think in the future maybe a good person would come from them? I mean, first of all, you can't know, and second of all, you don't care, because the focus is on the person. So why was this a necessary, one could almost say, prerequisite for Moshe before killing the person? But Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, to understand why in this instance Moshe would not have killed him had someone good come out of him at some later stage in history, we have to remember the way in which Moshe is conducting this entire interaction. There's a well-known idea which the Baalei HaMusar describe based on the pasuk in Hazinu, Kel Emuna Vein Ovel. Hashem is a faithful God and there's no wrongdoing. And somehow that's said in praise of Hashem, Ein Ovel, nothing ever goes wrong. But any lahavdil, any human being who is upright will never do anything wrong. What's the specific phrase or praise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The Ein Ovel, no bad comes out from what Hashem does. But the answer, say Mefarshim, is this is the difference between what we call Dinei Bezdin Shel Mata and Bezdin Shel Mala. When it comes to an earthly court, Bezdin Shel Mata, you can't know how your actions in punishing this individual will affect other people. And from a certain point of view, you cannot take it into consideration. After all, if a person's a murderer and then he deserves to be killed, okay, other people will be left in the wake of that absence. What if he's married? What if he has children? That will be a source of grief for them. But the Beis Din can't take that into account. Okay, how could they measure such a thing? And in that respect, justice is blind. Ein ladayan, ela masha ein avros. It's a fact of life. And what if there are other people that he once helped and they'll be sad? You can't factor that in. But in Shemayim they do, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu can. And what that means is sometimes, in order for something to happen, that means that all of the ripple effects and all of the reverberations of that event are also part of the Din Shemayim. And that's why we say, Kel Emuna Vein Ovel, nothing bad happens even as collateral from what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. That's Din Shemayim. So, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, what's happening with Moshe here is that his entire operation is really using the apparatus of Dinei Shamayim from the beginning. How does he know that this person deserves to be killed? Ruach HaKodesh. How does he know what happened that night? He wasn't there. Ruach HaKodesh. He's Moshe Rabbeinu. But Ruach HaKodesh is not admissible in a Beis Din. You can know, but that's not evidence. But he knows. And moreover, how does he kill the person? Shema Meforosh. That's not standard for any Beis Din. The entire way that mode, shall we say, that Moshe is operating on is that of Dinei Shamayim. That's how he knows, and that's how he acts. But if that's how he acts, then he also needs to act in accordance with this additional element of Dinei Shamayim. Namely, if someone else positive would have come out that now can't, it needs to be taken into account. And that's why in this instance, given the way that Moshe is operating, he needs first to establish that there will be no collateral loss in that respect, and then he acts. So this is Rashi, and again, Rashi brought the whole situation here, gave it a completely new element based on those diyukim, al pi chazal. There is a fascinating comment of the Midrash with regards to Vayifen Kovacho. And that is, Vayifen Kovacho, says the Midrash, Moshe looked here and there, Vayak Yenish, and he saw there was no man. Says the Midrash, Vayar ki ein ish mekane lakodesh baruch hu. He saw that no man was taking action to avenge this person and act on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's behalf. So that's very interesting. Because according to the Medrash, Vayar ki ein ish doesn't mean that he saw that there was no one there, but he saw that there was no one acting. I guess, b'makam shein anashim, hishtada lios ish. But no one was being an ish. And that further underscores the idea that there were other people there. And on the contrary, there were other people there. The Ksava Kabbalah explains, and again, the closer we look at these psukim, and we don't have time to look at all of the psukim in one setting, but each one for what it is, the end of Pasuk Yud Aleph says, he saw ish mitzri, make ish ivri me'echav. Me'echav. From among his brothers. What is the meaning of the word me'echav? What does it add? We already know that the Hebrews are his brothers, because the beginning of this very pasuk says, Vayigdal Moshe, Vayetze, El Echav. So we know that the Hebrews are his brothers. So why does it need to be reiterated that when we next refer to an Ivri, again we'll call him me'echav? That's a repetition. But that's why it says, Aksava Kabbalah, the Medrash looks at the word me'echav, not that the Hebrew, it's not describing the Ivri, it's describing the hitting. As if to say, not that the Ivri was me'echav, but this whole thing was happening, me'echav, from among his brothers, meaning there were people there. And that changes, says Aksava Kabbalah, the way we look at Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayifen Ko Vacho. He looks here, he looks there. Because according to the way we normally understand it, he looks here, he looks there to check that there's no one there. But there are people there, says the Medrash. So what are you looking for? He's looking to see if anyone's going to do something. He looks this way, nothing. He looks this way, nothing. Vayar ki einish, and he saw that no one was acting. So he took action. And of course, we can well understand why no one took action. They were cowards. Cowed, that is to say, in a way that he wasn't. They were intimidated in a way that he wasn't. But it's a completely different understanding of Vayifen Kovacho. What is he looking for when he looks here and there? And the meaning of Vayar Ki Ein Ish. I will say, having seen Rashi, having seen the Medrash, the biggest chiddush from what I have seen regarding this pasuk comes from the Chasam Sofer. And it's a chilling comment, as we'll see. The Chasam Sofer reminds us that there was a certain hierarchy here in terms of the enslavement of the Jewish people. That is to say, you have the Egyptian overseers, and they're known as Noksim. But under them were not the slaves. Under them were Jewish officers, known as the Shotrim. And very often, when the Egyptian wanted to do something, so he would get the shoter, the Jewish shoter, to do it for him. And if it was unpleasant, he would for sure get the Jewish shoter to do it for him. And such a thing was what was happening in this situation. The Chasam Sofer says, the word Mei Echav at the end of Pasuk Yud Aleph means he saw the Mitzri, and the Mitzri was beating the Ivri, but he didn't do it himself. He got another one of the Jews to do it. Mei Echav, he beat him, Mei Echav, through one of his brothers. He turned to one of the Jews, the Shotrim, who was under him, and says, I want you to beat that person to death. That's Mei Echav. And moreover, says Chasam Sofer, when Moshe kills the Mitzri, who clearly had done something terrible, it was more for what he did to the Jew that he forced to hit the other one than the one who was being beaten. Because there's something which is so grotesque about forcing one person to beat his fellow. And Moshe felt he was fully justified to do that. But there is a follow-up. And that's even worse. Because that was day one. What happens on day two? He goes out. He sees two Jews beating each other. And that's the point that Moshe runs away. He is now afraid of Paro. And how is he afraid? And why is he afraid? Says Chasam Sofer, because on day one, if all you've seen is a Mitzri forcing one Jew to hit another, so you can kill him and you can defend that. But if on day two, you go out and you see the Jews don't need to be forced by anyone and they're beating each other anyway, so then how can you defend the killing a Mitzri for doing something that Jew would do by himself? And that's the point that Moshe ran away. Because he's afraid for his life now, for Paro. And of course, the parallels do need to be spelled out about what the implications of that situation are. But this is the approach of the Chasam Sofer. Again, you see that the closer you look at the words, what's Mei Echav, where's Kovacho, what's Veyaki Einish. I will conclude just that we've seen three approaches already: Rashi, the Medrash, and Chasam Sofer. Hard to take leave of this section of the Parsha without referring to a very well-known idea that I heard from my father Zatzal. He did not cite a source, and people have written to me over the years asking me for the source, because this explanation has kind of has done the rounds. Possibly I've traced it to Rav Tzadok HaKohen, but still needs to be determined in terms of the source. But again, the Pasuk says, he sees the Mitzri is beating the Ivri, and he looks here and he looks there, and there's no one there, and then he kills the Mitzri. It's a Hasidic interpretation, and as we know from past experience, Hasidim are not bound in any way by the laws of syntax, grammar, or anything else. But there's an idea coming out. And what's the Pasuk saying? Moshe is in it grows up in a very interesting situation, because he kind of has a dual identity. He's Hebrew by birth, but he's Egyptian in a sense by upbringing. I mean, he grows up in Paro's palace. One could say that he's a kind of like a dual identity. He's a Hebrew Mitzri, or maybe an Egyptian Hebrew, but the two can coexist. However, on that day, Moshe reached a point where he realized that the two cannot coexist. They cannot both be part of his identity. Why? Because if you're both Mitzri and Ivri, what do when you see a Mitzri beating an Ivri? You cannot respond in a way that is integral to your entire personality, because you're either going to do something or you're not going to do something. So when the two parts of what Moshe perceived as making up his personality were locked in deadly conflict with each other, that was a defining moment for Moshe. He vayar ish mitzri. He saw ish mitzri, make ish ivri me'echav. And then what? Says Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayifen ko vacho vayar ki ein ish. He looks this way, he looks that way, and he sees there is no man. And where? What does this mean? And where is he looking? Says the Rebbe, he's looking at Moshe. He looks this way, he looks at one part of him, and seems to be Mitzri. And then he looks at the other part, so it's like Ivri. But they're in conflict now. And because they're in conflict, Vayar ki ein ish, he sees that there is no such person. There is no ish who's both Mitzri and Ivri. Not to their core. You can have an Ivri who lives in Mitzrayim, but there is no such thing as a Mitzri Ivri. And that's the point where Moshe needs to make his position known. Who is he? One of them has to go as part of his core identity. Says the Pasuk, Vayaches HaMitzri, he killed the Mitzri and buried him. Meaning, he deleted the Mitzri as part of his identity because he's not a Mitzri. He's an Ivri who lives in Mitzrayim. And as is always the case, not pshat, but always true. Vahameivin yevin, again, in terms of issues of identity, those words are relevant today as they were when whoever said them, said them. So, if we move now to the beginning of Perek Gimel, and we're back again to the story of the Jewish people. Moshe is about to become the leader of the Jewish people. And the beginning of Perek Gimel, the background is Moshe's tending the sheep, Moshe haya roes tzon yisro chosno, and then before we know it, it's the burning bush, and there's no going back. And the rest is our history. Pasuk Beis is already the snip. So the only background that we have to the whole revelation of the burning bush is Moshe's tending the sheep of Yisro. And there is a fascinating medrash that relates to this background, as we say, because it's not only historical background. How did he come to be in the desert? Because he's tending the sheep. It's conceptual background. How does he come to be chosen as a leader of the Jewish people? Because he's tending to the sheep. And what does this mean? So the medrash describes how Moshe, he's a shepherd, and all the sheep are there, and one goes missing. And what's happening? He goes to find it, and it's drinking. And Moshe carries. He picks it up and carries it. He said he didn't realize that it was weaker or tired or whatever. He carries it back to the fold. It says the Medrash, if you take care of Yisro's sheep like that, you can take care of my sheep. If you take care of Yisro's flock, you can take care of my flock. And as we can appreciate, if a person is to become the leader of the Jewish people, they need more qualifications than to be able to take care of sheep. Because the Jewish people are anything but sheep. But somehow it sounds like this is it. This is all you need. But how can it be all you need? But the Mefarshim explain. Of course you need every other leadership quality. But what's the moral of the story? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not interested in you as a leader of the Jewish people if you cannot also take care of the individual, if you cannot also take care of the solitary sheep. As if to say, it's often true that there are people who are they're national leaders in the sense that they can relate to the nation. But the nation is made up of people, and they do not always relate to those people that make up the nation. They're too busy with national concerns. There is no room for personal concerns. And that form of leadership is actually disqualified by the Torah. And so in a sense, once again, we see how the national and the personal, they blend. Because the Jewish people are made up of Jewish people. And a leader of the Jewish people is someone who has an interest and has the interest at heart of each of those people. And as the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't give greatness to a person until he tests him with something small. Because when you test him with something small, you see the greatness of the person. You see that what he has at heart, even as he makes decisions that affect the people as a whole, it's with the well-being of each and every person in mind. Recall I think, worthwhile mentioning. For one of the leaders of Torah leaders of the Jewish people of the last generation, Reb Moshe Feinstein, his name is well known. And there is a story, I did not see it in the book, but I happen to have inside information here. One of my Talmidim is married to a great-great granddaughter of Moshe Feinstein, so I got in touch with him. He verified the story. I personally feel the story should be well known, if not placed on the front page of the response to Igwas Moshe. And Maaseh Shehaya Kachaya, Reb Moshe Feinstein, he's in his later years, however he's in his 80s or whatever, and he needed to be hospitalized for a certain time. Now, people still need to be able to contact him. Reb Moshe Feinstein doesn't get the luxury of not being contactable. But they did screen his calls. And this is back in the day where phones were attached to walls and things were much more containable. So, and they had someone there manning the phone, and that's his. So it's the first Friday that Reb Moshe is there in hospital, and the phone rings. So whoever, his gabbai or his whatever. So they pick up the phone, and they say, yes. So the woman on the other end of the line, and she says, I'd like to speak to Reb Moshe Feinstein. I'd like to speak to Rabbi Feinstein. So, okay. So the screener asks, may I ask, what's the question? What is it about? So this woman said, I'd like to ask Rabbi Feinstein what time Shabbos comes in this week. So this person almost fell off his chair. I mean, here's Reb Moshe Feinstein, Posek Hador. We're talking about the weightiest of questions, corporate, personal, life and death, the whole thing. He's bringing the halachic community well into the 20th century, and someone's calling him up to ask him what time Shabbos comes in. So he very tactfully suggests to this woman that she might want to get hold of a luach, of a calendar, because then she can find out for herself. And this woman says to him, you know, I don't know who you are, but I just want to tell you one thing. For the last 30 years, I've been calling up Rabbi Feinstein every Friday to ask him what time Shabbos comes in. And he puts the phone down and goes and checks and comes to tell me. He never told me to get a luach. So you represent him. Why are you telling me to get a luach? And I think there's so much in that story, because you see that's mamish, like that's the sheep that Reb Moshe Feinstein, together with the weighty concerns, because his devotion and his dedication is to the Jewish people. But the Jewish people are made up of Jewish people, and whatever they need. So if they need a life or death psak, or if they need a complete scientific revolutionary psak for halacha, he's there to help. And if someone wants to know what time Shabbos is in, he's also there to help. They're the same people, and they just need different things. And this is true not only for the greatest, but I would say kal v'chomer, or more correctly, chomer v'kal, with regards to the lesser among us, who don't have such weighty. Sometimes we keep an eye on the bigger things, maybe not so much the smaller things. That's so much we can learn from Moshe Rabbeinu and from all those that emulated him. There is a Hasidic shavuot, again, the Rebbe was unknown, and again heard from my father. And again, it has nothing to do with the pshat, but it relates to Rabbi Akiva's famous statement. The pasuk says, "V'ahavta l'recha kamocha," love your neighbor as yourself. And Rabbi Akiva is on record as saying, "Zeh klal gadol b'Torah," and the simple meaning is, this is a great principle in the Torah, and that's the pshat, and it remains the pshat. But the Rebbe says, when Rabbi Akiva says, "Zeh klal gadol b'Torah," It was a form of a lament for his own experiences with his Talmidim, who, as we know, were found wanting in the area of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. L'nagu kavod zeh bazeh. But what happened? They never read the pasuk. The pasuk says V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. What happened? The answer is, it never made it out of the Torah. It stayed in the Torah. I mean, they read it, but they're here, that's there, and never the twain shall meet. And that's what Rabbi Akiva is saying. It's a great principle, but it stayed in the Torah. It shouldn't have stayed in the Torah. It should have been taken out. It should have been used to be Noah Kovet Zebazeh. And if I may use my own Hasidic license, to add maybe a PS to this idea. If the Rebbe says that that Rebbe Akiva is saying it's a great principle, but it stayed in the Torah, perhaps we may add that the reason why it stayed in the Torah is because it's a great principle. As if to say, the mistake was, when you see a great principle, you're prepared to use it for a great situation. In other words, it's epic. Will I ever apply it? Certainly, if something epic happens to me. If I need to save someone's life, if I need to find them a job, if I need to do something big, I'll use the big principle. But so much of our interaction with others are not big things. They're small things, and it just didn't fit. In other words, its size was what led to its inertia. Because it was its godliness left it in the Torah. And of course, the moral of the story is the greatness of Avtalecha Kamocha is not that it's there for great situations, it's that it's there for all situations. And that accounts for 99.9% of our situations. And that's really the Pasuk's way of telling us that even as we in our own experience have an eye on the big, but also the small things of which everything is made up should not go untreated as well. And thus we close our discussion with Chumash Shemos, and again we keep on going back. It's from national concerns to personal concerns, and ultimately comes together because the nation is made up of all of those people with their concerns, and the leader is the one who takes care of both the one and the other. We'll leave it over there.